Hi, I'm Tamara Copeland, here with the Washington Regional Association of Grantmakers, Putting Racism on the Table podcast series. If you've listened to other segments, you know that a group of philanthropists was interested in understanding how racism affects our ability to truly tackle the problems facing our society. Today, Dr. Robin DiAngelo, author of What Does It Mean to Be White, helps us understand the pervasiveness and impact of white privilege.
So I'm Robin DiAngelo, and I want to begin by drawing your attention to the fact that I'm white. And of course, part of being white is that goes against all my socialization, right? I was taught not to see myself as having a race. Race is what they had, not myself. And I was certainly taught not to be drawing attention to it or naming it. So how did I come to be, you know, standing in front of rooms of people day in and day out and drawing attention to my race? Well, for me, it started in the early 90s when I applied for a position as a diversity trainer. And back in the 90s, I'd never heard of that, but that sounded like the coolest job possible. You're going to go into the workplace and you're going to lead discussions on, you know, racial equity. And I thought, oh, I'm totally qualified for that. I mean, I'm a vegetarian, and I shop at Whole Foods, and, you know, we didn't have Priuses then, but if we did, I would have driven one like I do now. And I really did think, oh, well, this is all about open-mindedness, right? This is about being progressive, and I'm progressive, so I applied, and because everybody in the position to determine my qualifications was also a super nice, open-minded white person like me, I got the job. And I was in no way prepared or qualified for that job. I soon began to realize that open-mindedness is not at all what this is about. And in fact, I think that open-minded progressive like myself is really the most challenging when it comes to these topics, because the degree to which we think we get this, we're going to put our energy into deflecting any deeper reflection or any association with inequity. So I actually went on to get my doctorate in a field called whiteness studies. Anybody ever hear of that? For as long as academics have been studying race, the way we've gone about it is we study them, right? Like, what's up with them? Why do they have those problems? Let's figure them out. And for as long as we've been doing that, they've been looking at us saying, why don't you look at yourselves? You're our problem, right? And so in the early 90s, late 80s, scholars began to take up that call, right? What does it mean to be white, right? What is the relationship between groups? And that field emerged. It's called whiteness studies. So that's what I focus on. And I want to acknowledge a couple of things. There is no true race at the biological or genetic level the way we've been taught to think about it, right? It's not a scientific category. But as a social idea, it is profound in its meaning. You can predict people's life outcome. You can predict how long people will live by the racial assignment that we have at a given cultural moment, because these boundaries kind of shift over time. It is a socially constructed idea or concept, but very real in its meaning. So I'm aware of that. I think you've had some work on implicit bias. I hope so. And so maybe this will make sense to you. Regardless of whether you're aware of it or not, the way you will hear what I say today will be shaped by the fact that I'm white, right? And so what I have discovered is that there are things that I can say that can be heard, you know, much more easily by other white people. And that invokes the what I call the master's tools. I don't call it the master's tools dilemma. This is a famous quote from Audre Lorde. Anybody know who Audre Lorde was? She's passed now. She was a black activist, poet. And her quote was, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." So it's like, how do you challenge a system using the tools of the system? So by every measure across every institution, there's racial disparity in the United States. I think we know this, right? Across every institution, there's racial disparity. And we live in a society that is deeply separate and unequal, right? At the same time, our dominant narratives don't acknowledge that. Right. So what I'm going to show you is I was a former professor of education in a very large college of education. So we put out many, many teachers, and the program was 98% white. So it was rare for me to ever have a student of color in any of my classes. And we were 10 miles from Springfield, Massachusetts, a city that is 57% black and Latino. Right? So just keep that context in mind. And my students were juniors and seniors in their, you know, teacher education program, getting ready to go forth and teach in those schools. And on the first day of class, I would say, take out a piece of paper, and I'd like you to write me an anonymous essay on three questions. How racially diverse were your schools and neighborhoods growing up? What messages have you gotten about race across your lifespan? And what are some of the ways in which your race has shaped your life? And then I would collect those, and we would go back to them at the end of the semester. But I would make some predictions. I'd get them in an envelope, and I'd hold them up, and I'd say, I'm going to make some predictions, and we'll see. You grew up in mostly white neighborhoods, mostly white schools. The only message you've ever gotten is that everybody's equal, and you probably couldn't really write much more than about a paragraph on this deep perennial issue, right? So let's look at what is a classic representation of the hundreds of these anonymous essays I have from my future teachers. My neighborhood growing up was not racially diverse at all. Every family in my neighborhood was also Caucasian. Throughout my time in school, I've continually been taught that skin does not matter. Is that familiar to you? Right. Even if, you know, we may be a little more sophisticated, I think it's really key to notice, right? Like, what about this resonates with the ways that I've been taught to think about race, right? Particularly if we're white. So I see a really big contradiction in there. Do you? What's the contradiction? Yes, that's for me a key contradiction. And then that question I have is, how do we get taught that skin does not matter in segregation? All right? So keep those questions in mind because that contradiction in that question, because this, again, is dominant narrative, right? This is not a pre-civil rights narrative. This is a post-civil rights narrative, right? Okay. And I just thought about one other little opening disclaimer I like to make. I hope that you're uncomfortable at some point in my presentation, okay? because if you're not, I didn't do a good job. Because this is not a comfortable topic, right? I would say the default or the racial status quo, particularly for white people, is comfortable day in and day out. Has anyone ever met anyone who did not have an opinion on racism? If you're not sure, bring it up at your next family dinner. And ask maybe 2 to 3 questions and watch what happens. All right, so everybody has an opinion, right? And I'm going to say my first controversial thing if I haven't yet. If you are white, of course you have an opinion on this topic, right? But if you haven't devoted, sustained study, education, practice on this topic, your opinions are necessarily limited. All right? Now, how can I say such a thing, right? I don't know you. I don't know your lives. I don't know your experiences. I don't know how you've traveled. I don't know who you're partnered with. And yet, I actually am quite confident saying that. Because nothing in dominant society gives us the information we need to have a complex, nuanced understanding of arguably the most challenging, complex, nuanced, perennial dilemma since the founding of our country, right? If you are not focused and studying and thinking and struggling and practicing and mistake-making, you are not going to be able to expand your understanding. So hold your opinions lightly. The first thing we need is a shared set of definitions, because one of the things that makes this difficult to talk about is that we often use terms like prejudice, discrimination, and racism interchangeably. And so when I use those terms, I'm using them to I differentiate between them, right? So if you're using racism and prejudice as the same thing, you and I are going to have a conversation like this, right? Because we're just simply don't have the same framework. So let me kind of offer a shared framework. Prejudice is prejudgment. Everybody has it, and everybody kind of does it, if you will, right? And in the way that I'm talking about this, it's prejudgment about social groups to which you don't belong, right? So in a hierarchical society, we're set up in these social categories, right? So man, woman, rich, poor, old, young, right? Gay, straight. For every social identity, there's like an opposite. And then one side is the norm, and the other is a deviance from that norm, right? And so we have ideas, prejudgments about those social groups that are different from our own. Everybody has them, and we get them from everything. So across our lifespan, we are getting messages about other groups, right? And then when we act on those messages, we're now discriminating, right? Because the nature of prejudice is that it's not earned. It's kind of a projection, a generalized projection, right? So I was actually taught to see prejudice as bad, so I was one of those people that would have said, oh, I don't have a prejudice bone in my body. Have you ever heard that? And now I understand that's actually not humanly possible. There is no human objectivity. You can only make sense of the world through the cultural lens you were conditioned to make sense of the world through. Okay? And so if the feeling is hatred, we're going to get behaviors like violence and slander. Now, I definitely don't relate to that, which was another reason I would have told you I'm not prejudiced. But if we look at it as a more subtle, the feeling is discomfort, self-consciousness, apathy, lack of interest. Okay, I could be honest. I have those feelings about some social groups. Then we're going to get behaviors like avoidance, separation, either automatic benefit of the doubt or not automatic benefit of the doubt. And so then it's a little easier, I think, for most of us to say, okay, I have that. The way you see the world drives the way you respond to the world. And again, it can be really subtle, but it will come out in the practice of our lives. Okay? The best chance you have at challenging this is to be aware of what's in your head and get new information and all of that. And of course, you know, I'm really, really glad we now understand implicit bias, and that's harder to get at, right? But that's our best chance. Right? To deny we have it absolutely will not inoculate us from acting on it. All right, everybody has it. Everybody does it. Okay? But then when we move into oppression, we are in a different realm, right? So now we have a group's prejudice and discrimination backed by legal authority and institutional control. Now you have a group that is actually able to enforce and infuse their prejudice throughout the society. Basically, the group built the society. They set it up. They set up the institutions, the policies, the practices, and so they're able to infuse their prejudices into the fabric. And some of it will be conscious, and some of it will not be conscious. Right? It gets embedded in every institution. And also in cultural definitions of what's normal, real, beautiful, valuable, whose experience is attested to, whose is not, who tells the story, who doesn't, whose norms are used to judge, right? Okay. And there are different forms, right? So when you hear the ism words, that most of them end in isms, right? Racism, sexism, classism, heterosexism, anti-Semitism, ableism, right? You've heard these terms, and they allow us to capture or describe the particular form we're talking about, right? So there's these shared characteristics, and then they manifest in different places. And it also helps identify where am I positioned in that kind of binary, and then what would be my task from that position if I want to challenge this, right? So I want to use an example from sexism to launch us into talking about racism. So when did women get the right to vote in the U.S.? It's the 19th Amendment, I think, right? When did anybody know the year? It's okay if you don't. 1920. Who gave it to us? Because we literally weren't seated in the seats of institutional power. We didn't control the institutions. We didn't have the vote. We couldn't grant ourselves the vote. So you see that difference, right? Only men could grant that to us. Could an individual woman be prejudiced against a man? Absolutely. Could an individual woman make a man's life miserable? I like to say it's 2016. I've been accused of this at least two times. But could women as a group deny men's right to vote? No. Could they grant themselves the right to vote? No. So when I say racism, sexism, I'm talking about that system of inequitable structural power, not individual prejudice and acts of discrimination, right? And so let's look at it in a couple different ways. Clearly, men had to get on board, right, in order and talk to other men and grow the movement and eventually grant women the right to vote. So there were allies amongst men. And yet, of course, they still benefited from patriarchy, right? They still benefited from a system that conferred something as profound as the right to vote to their group and not another, right? So when we talk about privilege, you can think about it in that way, right? Not so much good or bad or intended or even could you feel privilege, but just the reality that the society is set up to benefit your group. I think about it as a fish either swimming with the current, and of course when you swim with the current, you don't know there's even a current, but when you swim against it, you're acutely aware, right? And also notice every institution worked together, right? So wasn't just the House and the Senate. So you had the clergy preaching from the pulpit that it was God's will that women not vote. Now try coming up against God's will. You're pretty much screwed, right? That's going to be hard to challenge. You've got the male-dominated or controlled psychiatry, right? So the psychiatrists wrote studies, and they said women are inherently irrational. You can't give them the right to vote. Then you had the medical field, also, of course, male-dominated. And they wrote studies, and I'm not making this up. Go to those old history books. They wrote studies that said things like, well, if woman thinks and uses her brain, the blood will flow upward away from the uterus, and the babies are just not going to be so good. So we can't have that. And then you had the professors, and ultimately, the military. If women were to rise up in the street, right? So every institution. This is why it's so hard, right? It's so embedded. And certainly we didn't get it the first time we asked or as nicely as we asked, right? It's usually decades of struggle, right? Because you're not just up against policies and practices, you're up against ideology, beliefs. But also let's notice that the way we had the conversation is part of it, right? It's so normalized and taken for granted, it's really difficult to see, right? So let's just look at some stats. So this is today. Okay, I actually do believe, and I don't know how this will land, we're in Washington, D.C. I think that's the power above all others. It's like the 1%, right? 98% male. This is the U.S. Senate, 80% male. House of Representatives, 82% male. Supreme Court, up until recently, 66% male. I mean, just look at that homogeneity. And who's, right, legal authority, institutional control. Who gets to make decisions that impact everybody's life? Institutionalized inequality is deeply rooted, embedded, taken for granted. It's not fluid. It doesn't change over time. The same groups who have controlled the institutions from the founding continue to, right? And I'm confident that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, patriarchy will not end that day, right? Any more than it ended when women got the right to vote. Facebook always puts out these little happy holiday things. I don't know if you've ever seen them. So this one came out on August 26th, which I guess is the anniversary of suffrage, women's suffrage, right? Happy Women's Equality Day. Which women got the right to vote in 1920? And this is another way that oppression works, right, is the dominant group's experience stands in as everyone's experience, right? So while we were oppressed as women, as white women, we were privileged, right? There's not a universal woman's experience. You know, race, class, sexuality profoundly shape my experience of womanhood, if you will. I think another example of this, I'll just go for it, is the 4th of July. What are we celebrating on the 4th of July? There's just one word. Independence. And what's the year that goes with the date? 1776. So our whole country is celebrating independence in 1776. What was going on related to issues of independence and freedom in this country in 1776? Human enslavement, right? That had been gone on for hundreds of years and would go on for another 100 or so, right? So again, whose story? So racism is a form of institutional oppression. It's a system that works on multiple levels and results in an unequal distribution of basically everything between white people and people of color overall, with whites as the beneficiaries of that distribution. Marilyn Frye has a metaphor of a birdcage. I think it's a beautiful metaphor to illustrate oppression, the difference between individual acts and a system. So if you walk up to that birdcage and you put your face against the bars and to look at the bird, you're going to get a pretty unobstructed view, right? You're just going to see maybe a little bit of the bars in your peripheral vision. That's a very micro or myopic view. It's an individual view. And you look at the bird and you say, what's the problem, right? The little door's open. Why don't they just fly away? Why doesn't that bird just do this, that, or the other, and then it wouldn't have any problems? But if you step back, you begin to see bars and bars and bars, and you begin to see this interlocking system where it doesn't make it impossible for that bird to fly away, it makes it unlikely. And it makes us enables us to predict that it probably won't, or it's certainly going to have many, many, many more barriers than a bird not in that cage. So what are some of those bars? Well, we have our institutions, we have our culture, ideology, the burden of representation, invisibility, isolation, unacknowledged historical trauma. I mean, there are many, many, many bars. So you can see what I'm doing here is trying to move us out of the dominant idea that if I am open, I couldn't be part of any of this, right? That this is a matter of conscious bias or dislike, which I don't have, therefore I'm not connected to this. And I'm trying to say the whole system is set up to reproduce this inequality. And unattended, that's what it will do. So I think the most brilliant, clever, effective adaptation of racism post-civil rights is what I call the good-bad binary, right? So post-civil rights, it became bad to be racist. And that seems like a positive thing, because racism's bad. But you always have to ask yourself, how does it function? And I would say it functions beautifully to make it very, very difficult to get white people to look at what we've internalized, the messages we've internalized, our privilege, our investments. Because what we hear, if you try to connect us to the system, is you just said I was a bad person. And that is unbearable to me. and I'm going to put everything I have into countering that attack. Have you ever seen a white person get defensive in a conversation about racism? Anybody? Okay. And if you yourself are feeling a little defensive, just ask yourself, is this rooted in this idea that she's suggesting I'm a bad person? Right? So if we're going to fill this in, we know that a racist is ignorant and bigoted and prejudiced and mean-spirited and old and Southern, and they drive pickup trucks because we got to get some classism in there, right? That's your racist. And your not racist is good. And they're educated and progressive and open-minded and well-intended and young and Northern, and they live in Portland and they shop at Whole Foods. This way of positioning you're either a good person or a bad person, or you're a good white or a bad white, is just not useful. All of us have been conditioned to participate. and this is getting in the way. And our films, our movies reinforce this idea. There's usually the good whites and the bad whites, and we totally identify with the good whites. So let's look at some of these narratives. I was taught to treat everyone the same. Has anyone ever heard that? Okay, that's not actually humanly possible. It's not humanly possible to teach people to treat everyone the same or to see everyone the same. We're subjective human beings. We're always responding to the perceptions of people's race, their age, their class, their gender. We're responding, whether we're aware of that response or not. If I'm standing in the elevator chatting with someone else in the elevator, I know whether that's a man or a woman in there, right? Or at least my perception. And it shapes what I'm going to talk about in there, right? We're always responding. And here's another one. I see people as individuals. I don't care if you're pink, purple, polka dotted. Okay, ever heard that one? So if that's in your vocabulary, I'm going to ask you, please never say it again. Okay? Never say again, I don't care if you're pink, purple. anything that begins with I don't care is probably not a great strategy in a sensitive conversation. But people don't come in purples and pinks and polka dots. And so whether it's intentional or not, the impact of that is very demeaning. Right, let's get real. Racism in our society is real. It shapes people's lives. Let's talk about it in a real way. Okay. It's in the past. It doesn't have any meaning. Everyone struggles, but if you work hard. My parents weren't racist, that's why I'm not racist. Or my parents were racist, that's why I'm not racist. It doesn't really matter what comes in front. What comes behind must always be I'm not racist. 'Cause I'm a good person, right? All right, so-and-so just happened to be black, but race has nothing to do with this. Okay. That's another one I would actually drop, regardless of race, or those kinds of qualifiers that suggest you can remove race from an interaction, and I would suggest you actually can't. These are all pretty much colorblind narratives, right? I don't see it, it doesn't matter to me. Colorblind narratives have not been useful. We're kind of trying to move away from them. I'll give you the ones folks use. I work in a very diverse environment. I have people of color in my family. Okay, has anybody ever heard a white person in a conversation about racism use some version of those? A racist has conscious dislike. A racist does not like people of color and knows it. Right? And I'm not a racist. Well, if we go under the surface and we think about it, I work in a very diverse environment. So basically a racist couldn't tolerate the sight of a person of color three cubicles down from them. Right? Or here's another one I hear a lot. I used to live in New York. But you like that one. Have you ever heard that? All right, so what am I saying to you? I've seen people of color. I walk by them. That's why I'm not racist, right? So this idea that a racist actually couldn't tolerate the sight of people of color, right, would run and I assure you that someone who is consciously or explicitly racist certainly could tolerate the sight, right? So if you think about it, it's actually a little bit absurd, right? This idea that this is my evidence that I couldn't be racist. Oh, I do want to say something about people of color in your family. I do think one of the antidotes to new racism, if you will, is to build authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships. And our society doesn't set us up to do that. Yes, we have colleagues in the workplace, but who do we really live near? Who's at our dinner table? In those ways, most of us don't, right? But that doesn't mean there's no racial dynamics that are going to manifest in your relationship, right? And I think about it around gender, right? I mean, I'm married to a man. All right, he loves me. I love him. His sexism didn't disappear the day we fell in love, I'll tell you that. Right? There's gender dynamics between us. Right? There will be racial dynamics in this society between people. So this doesn't exempt us. It certainly makes us probably have more understanding than not. My children are so much more open. The research shows that by 3 in 4, all children know the racial hierarchy. They know, and I'm just going to say this, it may be hard to hear, it's better to be white. That is the message of our society. And so when we romanticize them, we're not really preparing them to address that. The pattern across the nation is segregation, okay? Particularly for white people. Most white people grow up in racially segregated neighborhoods, right? You know, you may have been able to identify one or two different, you know, and where they were. The one exception to that is if you are white and you did not grow up in a segregated neighborhood, you were likely urban and poor or working class. That's the one exception. And generally, you don't stay in those neighborhoods because upward mobility takes you away, and we don't tend to maintain those early relationships. Okay, so let's look at this pattern. So most of us grow up in racial segregation. So I'm being told everybody's equal, and even if my parents didn't tell me that, certainly my schools, right? I'm told everybody's equal, but we don't live together. Why is that? And where are they, and why, and what have I been taught to associate with that space where they are, right? And how was I taught that? What message, was I encouraged to know and explore those places, or in many ways to avoid, right? So there are very deep messages in segregation. And I'm going to give you a quote from one of my students to kind of unpack how we construct, if you will, segregation. So she said, "I was really lucky. I grew up in an all-white neighborhood, so I never learned anything about racism." All right. You know, and again, I think she may have been more naive than a lot of us to put it that way, but I also recognize much of that narrative for myself, right? This idea. So let's kind of see what's all in that one sentence. This idea that there's no race in an all-white neighborhood, right? And I was certainly taught that way. I don't have race. They have race, right? And that race doesn't really begin until I interact with a person of color. Right, we will often begin, if you ask white people to talk about, you know, their racial narratives, they will begin them when they were either told something or they interacted. Right, this idea that a white neighborhood is racially neutral. Right, and I would argue that it's alive and active. It is an active space of socialization that we are continually getting deep messages in. Right? The other thing she does is, and this is probably the most pernicious perversion of what I would say is the true direction of harm, but if she was lucky because she avoided that terrible thing called racism because they weren't there, who has it and who brings it to whom in her construct? Right, people of color would bring that terrible thing here, and they weren't here, so we didn't have it. I would probably say to her, there weren't enough people of color in your environment to surface it in a way that you recognized it, right? Okay. Just keep thinking about what I'm trying to do here is move us past this kind of, again, this idea that it's just a matter of what we're told and to see how saturated it is, right? And how those messages from the time we were begun are in there. So this other idea that an all-white neighborhood is just a fluke or an accident or, right, rather than the result of decades of policies and practices, right, an all-white neighborhood is kind of an intentional construct, right? And today we see those, they're it's no longer legal to take out a map and draw a red line around, you know. But we do it in other ways. We do it in the ways we fund schools. We do it in good, bad school and neighborhood narratives. I think you know that subprime mortgages were aggressively pushed on people of color, even when they could afford better loans, right? That, again, this is not just a fluke or a human preference. If you are white, You pretty much, from the time you began and you could get through graduate school, relentlessly reflected by the person in front of the room, right? You could get to graduate school never having a teacher that was not of your own race, right? And maybe the third grade Spanish teacher or, you know, the coach, you know, those examples. If you're a person of color, there are a few exceptions in certain parts of the country, but overall, the norm there is you rarely, if ever, saw yourself reflected in those teachers in front of the room. They're role models. They're the holder of authority. They get to determine who's smart, who's capable, who belongs where. So do you think the teaching force is getting more or less white? What do you think? It's actually getting more. It's between 83 and 93% white across the nation, at the same time that schools are getting more segregated. We actually are almost to pre-Brown versus Board of Education levels of school segregation. So the pattern across the U.S. again is, if you are white, you've only had teachers of your own race, and it is an exception if you are a person of color to have teachers of your own race. So that's a vastly homogeneous teaching force. They answer these questions the same way everybody answers these questions, right? That they grew up in mostly white neighborhoods and only ever had mostly white teachers. So where do we get our understanding of people of color from then? We get them from deeply problematic sources. Okay, so I'm going to say to you, these teachers individually are well-meaning people. They do a really hard job, right, for very little kind of value granted. And yet that is very, very significant because they have very problematic ideas and understandings, but they're in the position to determine who's well-behaved, who belongs where. We have empirical evidence of deep inequality in those assessments, in who gets punished for what, right? In who gets sent to special education, in essentially the school-to-prison pipeline, right? Because collectively, and there is research that shows that young white females who are the predominant K through 6 enter schools with a fear of young black males. Now, how would you not have a fear of young black males if your understanding is consumed from media? Right? How many of you read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me? That book. So I want you to think about that book and then think about We Don't Know Our History, right? I have a friend who puts it like this. It gives me the chills when she does it, so I'm going to do it. Pretty much all of us are taught by white people who've been taught by white people who've been taught by white people who've been taught by white people. I could go on using textbooks written for and about white people. If someone does speak up and we don't understand, or it makes us uncomfortable, or we feel like, oh, are you trying to say, then we don't always listen or value what they bring. What I'm about to say here, no person of color could say in this society, but pretty much all white people could say, right? So keep looking at how you've been shaped, right? So first I was born into a culture in which I belong. In virtually any situation deemed normal, neutral, or valuable, I belong. I belong at that administrative meeting, at that church service, block party, dealing with my daughter's teachers, her camp counselors, that wedding. I was represented. I've been represented in the government. Whites are the norm for humanity. Those who write and direct our films are our cultural authors. They tell our stories. They shape all of our ideas about normalcy, family, sexuality, romance, conflict, adventure. And they are vastly white, and in this case, upper-class male. They are the least likely to have authentic cross-racial relationships because of their positions, but they get to represent the other. I think that the most powerful way that my life has been shaped by my race is that I could be born into, I could learn, I could play, I could worship, I could study, I could love, I could work, and I could die in racial segregation. Most white people do live the majority of our lives in racial segregation. and not one person who's ever mentored or loved or guided me has ever suggested that I had lost anything. I'm going to say it again a few different ways. White people measure the value of our spaces by the absence of people of color. I know what a good neighborhood is. I know what a good school is, right? If I just followed the trajectory that my loving parents laid out for me in my good neighborhood, my good school, my good career, my good degree, I could easily have no authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships, easily. And no one suggested I would have lost anything. The fundamental message of segregation, and every moment we call a school good and a neighborhood good, the fundamental message is there's no inherent value in the perspectives or experiences of people of color. You get to this point, and we get to say who's objective and who isn't, who can best determine someone's qualifications, right? When we do get diversity at the table, I mean, think about it, right? All my teachers, all the role models, all the spokespeople have been white. And so it's hard for me to even take in or value that perspective, especially if I don't understand it, right? And so this is the dynamic that plays out when we're wanting to change these. This is what we're up against. We have to get out of denial that it shapes how we come to the table, all of us, right? And it isn't about being good people. But we do have to really take responsibility, right, for it, and think about it and keep working on it. And if we don't change the water, then we get more people of color, but we often don't retain them or support them, right? I'm actually at a point in my work where I think the most hostile, toxic environment for people of color every day is unexamined whiteness. Can you see how this would come out of my pores? I don't have to do anything. It kind of would be the way I am and the way what I notice, what I don't notice, how I respond. And this leads to white fragility. If we map out the pillars that I think prop up new racism, right, that allow us to feel individually exempt and still have these outcomes, I think this idea that we couldn't be good people and also be complicit. This idea that we could be exempt from the deep messages that surround us 24/7. This idea that we're having a universal experience, right? That what's welcoming to me would be welcoming to everybody. Implicit bias, relentless messages of white as ideal, and segregation. I think segregation is probably the most powerful tool. Good, bad, binary, and segregation. I'm hoping you're noticing, or you see me as a fairly empowered person. I feel fairly empowered. This isn't about guilt, right? It's about responsibility, right, and practice. If we're not actually demonstrating in the practice of our lives, then us just saying, oh, yes, I see this, is not really, it's meaningless, right? So white fragility is a concept that I came up with in my work where, because of all these things, it is inevitable that I have blind spots, right? It's inevitable. It's inevitable that I'm going to inadvertently reveal some of these biases, right? But unfortunately, when people try to give me feedback I've done that, it doesn't tend to go well, right? That generally the response is defensiveness or hurt or feeling unfairly accused, right? If you've ever had a racial conflict in the workplace and see those reactions from a white person who someone's tried to tell them, yeah, I know you didn't mean to, but like the resume study, you know about the resume study? Most people do so, that these resume readers, based on the name, were racially discriminating. If you went to those resume readers and you said, you just racially discriminated, I'm pretty confident they would vehemently deny that they had, because they didn't know that they had, and get very, very defensive and feel unfairly accused of something, right? And I call that white fragility, kind of how we fall apart when you try to talk to us about this stuff. All the ways, you notice all the disclaimers I have to make and all the carefulness in order to just put this information out, because we're so sensitive to it or about it. But how does that sensitivity function? It tends to make people not want to try with us again, right? So it's like, okay, I tried once, it didn't go well, I'm just not going to try anymore. It's actually a moment of trust when a person of color tells a white person something they just said or did was problematic. That's a moment of trust. If you have a friendship with a person of color and they're never giving you feedback on racism, it's probably not as close as you think it is, right? Because maybe they tried, didn't go well, or they just sense that you're not receptive, right? So this is the next barrier. It's actually incredibly transformative and liberating when you realize, of course I'm seeped in this stuff. Thank you. I don't want to be doing things I don't know I'm doing. Thank you so much, rather than, oh my God, how dare you? You know, or all the other reactions that we have. It's inevitable. But I also want to say, when I choose to be silent about something I see as a white person, that's actually a moment of what I would call white solidarity. And that's not the same kind of choice, right? Because my position is different, right? That ends up protecting those blind spots. And so this is a really key point, is we cannot depend on people of color. It's a piece of the equation, but we also have to educate ourselves enough and be paying attention enough that we also see it ourselves, right? We're not always going to see it, but we can't put that burden. That's an incredible weight to put on people of color. Is, hey, do you just let me know if I do anything and I'll just carry on, right? It's like, oh, that's not fair. Yeah. Given... It rarely happens without a lot of agony, right? Like, oh God, should I? Shouldn't I? What? You know, what's going to happen? But if I don't, but oh, do I? What? Right? It takes a lot of energy. Again, because I think we're up against that good bad binary, and unfortunately, often the white person hears it as that we're bad. Here's my ideas for. How we can begin or continue this, be willing to tolerate the discomfort associated with an honest appraisal and discussion of internalized superiority. There's no way we can't internalize superiority. I know those are really bad words, but the way I'm using them is that these messages, and all the ways I've tried to show you in this short amount of time, again, whether we're conscious of it or not, it's there, right? And challenge our own racial reality. Recognize that we have a limited worldview, a limited understanding, that it is a most particular. We're not objective and they're biased. Here's another one I would drop from your vocabulary, the race card, right? Drop that one. Also drop reverse. There is no reverse form of oppression, right? Begin to understand people of color's racial realities through authentic relationships rather than through the media or unequal relationships, and actually take action.
Did you hear something that you hadn't thought of before? Let's keep the conversation going. Tell your friends, family, and colleagues about this new podcast series, Putting Racism on the Table. And leave me a message at copeland@washingtongrantmakers.org or via Twitter at Bragg Prez, WRAGPREZ.